Hi, I'm Meredith.
And I'm Katie.
And you're listening to I'm Not Scared, You're Scared,
a horror movie podcast.
If you are a fan of the show, please like and follow us on iTunes and Spotify and review us. It'll help spread the word.
Also, you can follow us on Instagram at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared, or email us at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared at gmail.com.
Thanks for joining us. We're here
back again.
We are back to talk about One Missed Call.
Mm-hmm. Continuing our summer theme of technologically based horror. This is, I think, the only one we're doing that has to do with telephones. There's internet, there's robots. The last two episodes have been about photography. But now we're gonna explore the world of telephones.
They cannot be trusted.
They cannot be trusted.
In a world full of AI now.
Ooh, yeah.
It's not looking great.
Nope.
And the horror genre knew for a very long time.
Well in advance of the reality.
Trying to warn us all.
Uh-huh.
And we're here to warn you too.
Yep. It's not too late to stop trusting your phone.
Yeah. So, you did the recap this time, so I will ask, what's new with you?
Yeah.
What's new with you? Do you
have anything? Yeah. So I had mentioned on a previous episode that one of my students at the end of the year gave me a copy of one of Stephen King's new books, short story collections called You Like It Darker, I think is what. I couldn't remember the title exactly, and you looked it up.
I always have a hard time with titles like that.
Yeah, it's vague, just like the movie titles are vague. But anyway, so I'm almost done with it, but I wanted to share a little bit about one of the longer short stories, because as I've said on this podcast and I've said in person a million times, that one of the things I admire so much about Stephen King as an author is his ability to produce both captivating short stories and also captivating 1300 page novels. Ugh. You would think that an author would be good at one and not the other, but he can really do both.
With the exception of some of his endings.
Yes, which he is very self-aware and self-effacing about.
He laughs about it. Yeah. And we're like, yeah, you little scamp.
Yeah. But even within the short story collections, sometimes you have something that's approaching novella length. And then in this book, there was one short story. It was only 4 or 5 pages long.
Oh.
But one of the longer ones from You Like It Darker is actually, it reminded me a little bit of Duma Key. Because it's set in the Florida Keys, on an island in the Florida Keys. And it's a ghost story in the same way that Duma Key was a ghost story.
Yeah.
But the cool thing about it is the main character is this man in his 70s who is the dad from Cujo.
Ooh,
and so his experience with that happening to his wife and son 40 years previous plays into the story and the events in this new short story.
That's an interesting tidbit.
Yeah, okay.
That was a little bit challenging relationship.
Yeah, it was. We know that Stephen King likes to do those Easter eggs. It's his multiverse that he's created, and he references locations and characters and events from other stories in and throughout, his novels and his short stories. And so if you are familiar with his work, it's always exciting when he makes one of those references or mentions when this happened, or oh, this person. And you're like, I remember that. I read that too. Mm-hmm. And so I was pretty jazzed that when I realized very early in this short story that was the connection to Cujo. And he also he tells the story in between. And so you get the explanation of how he got from the events in Cujo to where he is now.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that feeds into and serves the story that's being told in this short story. So I thought that was very cool. And then it also put me in a mood to watch some of the classic Stephen King movies, the kind of old school ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so I rewatched Christine, which is always a favorite. It's a John Carpenter. And it's
R.I.P. Just kidding.
Which, you know, is just, it's fun. And they're very dated. They have that look, that mid-80s Stephen King movie look. Mm-hmm. So I rewatched Christine and I rewatched Cujo, which, you know, obviously is really kind of an achievement in terms of, like, just movies Dee
Wallace
overall.
Is so good in that
She's
movie
She's so amazing.
Too.
The little boy, his performance is just destroys you.
Yeah.
And what they did to achieve that film with an actual animal. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we know that dogs can be trained, like, dogs can be impeccably trained. It's amazing what people are able to accomplish in terms of getting a dog to do certain things, to perform in films and commercials and all the, you know, ways that they use them. But what they accomplished with the live animal that they used to film Cujo back in the 80s is so impressive that they were able to make it so scary and so believable.
Yeah.
I was like, man, we should do an episode on Cujo someday. That movie's so great.
It is. It's a classic.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do a Stephen King.
Yeah.
Project.
Yeah. I mean, like, we could do it. His birthday is in September. So maybe we could do, like, a happy birthday
episode.
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
But yeah, so that's, I've been kind of snuggling up with some summer Stephen King. What's new with you?
So I told you I've been watching a lot of book talk,
mm-hmm.
like TikTok, but book talk. Mm-hmm. And there's a lady I follow. I should probably learn her name, but I haven't. But mm-hmm. she's fun. And she talks about different horror movies or books that could be maybe in the horror classification, but maybe aren't.
Mm-hmm.
So I filled up my library queue and I held a bunch of books and have a bunch of audiobooks. And this one I'm halfway through and I like it. It's really good. It's written by a Japanese author. And it's called How High We Go in the Dark. And it's a lot of different short story vignettes by different characters that will eventually come together. But it's pretty good. And it takes place a lot in the Bay Area or in Japan.
Oh.
And it's basically, it's the premise is this guy, he goes to take on his daughter's work. And she has passed. And she was, like, in her 30s. And they're dealing with ice melt, with discovery of different, basically, things that are coming because of global warming,
mm-hmm.
things that are defrosting and unleashing different things
in
the world, like things that can be studied and researched. And they find a corpse of a child that's, like, thousands and thousands of years old. And his daughter, unfortunately, she was able to do much research on this, she has passed away. But he also is a professor, scientist at Berkeley or somewhere in the Bay. And he goes, and it's in the Antarctic, and he goes to this, it's basically an expedition kind of thing. So he goes and they discover a virus that has been basically frozen.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the melts that's happening, it's like unleashed again into the world. They call it a plague.
Mm-hmm.
And it does all these weird things to you, and it attack the children and elderly, or children come down with it first. And it's like different iterations of a plague.
Okay.
Like what's going on, then all these people are sick, and then like different treatments, and then the funeral industry and how things, you know, research. And it's very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like more than halfway through, and there's some kind of sci-fi elements, some horror, body horror elements, but I'm finding it very entertaining and compelling, at least.
Cool.
So hopefully it'll end. I mean, there are some parts where I'm like, oh, this is making me feel feeling. Like, oh my gosh, this is like...
I'm not dead inside.
Yeah, like there's this one part where they have... it's a big wig guy. He created basically a park that has... It's called Funland or something. And it's for children who are plague victims that are in their last days.
Oh, yeah. So like a group make-a-wish scenario?
Sort of. But then also the final ride will... cause their death, basically.
Wow.
But it's like either that or the plague ward, where you die in a hospital.
Yeah.
So it's like, which one do you choose?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like take your child to have balloons and see animals and do other things, and they take this final ride called Osiris,
mm-hmm.
And that's the end.
Yeah.
So it was pretty interesting. It was told from the perspective of a park worker. Mm-hmm. And then he meets a woman and with her child who's very pretty. He's doing okay. There's a lot of like, he's gotten a lot of transplants and things and like different experimental drug trials and things like that. But it's like in the end, it's just fighting against something right. that's not going to.
It's a losing battle. Yeah.
Exactly. So there's that, and that I was like, oh my gosh, this is so crazy, but it's pretty good. So hopefully I'll have more to say about it next time. Yeah. Either give it a big recommendation or not. But also, Victor and I have been watching. Could relate to the game with season 3 of White Lotus. Mm-hmm. It's played and wrapped up for a long time ago, but we're slowly making our way through. Television, we kind of, because honestly, during the school year, I'm tired and I want to go to bed at like 9 o'clock.
Exactly. Yeah. Anytime I would try to watch, it's like I'm just gonna fall asleep in the middle of this. So
right. So we're slowly making our way through that. So anyway, reading and watching TV, not much else.
Yeah.
And I got a cool vacuum, so I'm excited about that.
Yes. She was just showing it to me. It is spectacular.
It's very fancy.
It's very sexy.
I know. I'm so excited.
She's just standing. She's posing with it.
Look at my vacuum. It's the little things, listeners. Mm-hmm. So we are talking about One Missed Call. I can't. Okay, I chuckled while I said that.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is going to be another one of those, like our frequent, constant listeners are going to recognize that this is a lower tier horror movie that Meredith has reduced herself to watching for my benefit.
I checked it out from the library.
Yeah.
So I felt happy that I didn't have to pay money.
You didn't pay for it. Yeah.
And you know, libraries are amazing place.
We gotta support those.
Support the libraries.
Yeah. So One Missed Call did come out the same year as our previous movie Shutter in 2008. And there's actually a ton of familiar faces in it that I'll like note as we go through. But the two main characters are played by Shannon Sossaman and Ed Burns. And Shannon Sossaman, she like my touchstone for her has always been this movie, A Knight's Tale, with Heath Ledger. That was terrible. She was an it girl there for a minute. She was like making movies.
We loved A Knight's Tale.
Yeah. It's so good. She was in 40 Days and 40 Nights with Josh Hartnett. She did an episode of Special Victims Unit. And then also, obviously, she was the lead in Sinister 2, which unfortunately did not stand up to how good the first one was. But anyway, she was in it.
She's in The Rules of Attraction, which I was so excited about that movie because I loved the book. Mm-hmm. But the movie kind of was a stinker.
Yeah.
Which is too bad because it has so many like recognizable people.
Yeah.
But I think she kind of stepped away from acting to raise a family or something. So.
Yeah, there was a pretty big gap between like her early 2000s work and then because Sinister 2 was like maybe she hadn't, it seemed like she hadn't made a movie in like 5 years, 10 years, something like that. But anyway, she's serviceable. You know, you wouldn't call her like the most gifted actress in the world, but she does the job.
Uh-huh.
And then Ed Burns, he's cute. He's a charmer. He's one of those guys, those like kind of nondescript good looking guys you can plug in. He was in 27 Dresses and
I get him confused sometimes with Dermot Mulroney.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of those guys that are just a little interchangeable because they're handsome, but not in a super unique way. And they're decent actors, but not in a really interesting or memorable way always. Mm-hmm. But they fill that role of the, like the good looking dude.
Yeah.
Right?
Or So
I'm not hating on him.
No, I just get them confused.
Yeah. Okay, so those are our two main characters, but like I said, as we go through, I'll be kind of pointing out other people here and there. So the movie opens on an old brick hospital building called St. Luke's, and it is ablaze. A tiny blonde girl is rescued with her teddy bear from the burning building, but when an EMT outside asks where her mommy is, she only stares up at one flaming window in silence. So we're like, rut-row, like out the gate.
Uh-huh.
Meredith is already unimpressed.
Hired her. They're like, you need to just look haunted.
Yep.
And you need to stare
off
into space.
She nails it. She nails it. She barely, this character delivers one line in the entire movie. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So now we're in a gorgeous Japanese style garden backyard. And Shelley, who this is like the first recognizable face, is an actress named Megan Good. I love her from the movie Unborn, which is another one.
I don't recognize her at all.
I'm hoping that we do Unborn someday because I love that one. Anyway, so Shelley is on the phone talking about some prank, saying she wasn't, quote, just seeing things. She's having this conversation. But then moments later, while she's in the garden looking for her cat, she sees something glowing in the bottom of the koi pond. When she leans in to find out what it is, an arm bursts out of the water and pulls her under. This red ball bobs to the surface of the water before the same arm bursts out and grabs the cat, too, which seems unnecessary. Mm-hmm. But then we see Shelley's cell phone lying back on the table where she was using it as it mysteriously starts scrolling through her list of contacts all by itself. Dun dun. Meredith, I wish you guys could see Meredith's face right now. She is like, I just got to get through this. Images under the opening credits include many showing the saturation of cell phone use in modern society.
I'm sorry, but that woman in mm-hmm. the first scene basically is like, well, she's not important. Like, I don't know. It's like there's no context. We're supposed to, I'm not scared at all because I'm like, who is she? Who I don't even care about this. You know, so I feel like a little precursor, a little something mm-hmm. before that. Just to give her a little bit of humanity, I think.
Oh,
could have helped the viewer connect with her a bit more than me just be like, okay, so what?
Yeah, or, I don't think that they really need you to connect with her. Because, like, her dying is just in service of the plot.
I guess.
But you're right, because they didn't. I mean, that scene is, like, 2 minutes long. Yeah. So there's no character development at all. All it is, like, some facts that get, you know, woven into the events that follow.
Yeah.
But maybe if you'd seen The Unborn, then you would have cared more about
her. I would have cared more about her. Megan!
Yeah, but we need to know. Like, we need to know about Shelley. We need to know what she said on that phone call and what happens to her. Like, everything that you see in this first scene does end up being important. I'm really glad that Victor decided to mow the lawn right now. Is that not Victor?
No. It's a lawn...
Lawnmower man.
Lawn care people.
Lawnmower man.
Lawnmower man.
Ooh, do another Stephen King. Okay. So after the opening credits, we're at a college house party and we meet Brian, who you might not have recognized as an actor named Johnny Lewis. He was in Alien versus Predator Requiem.
I have no recognition of him.
I love him.
He's like blonde guy.
Yeah. And then, so Brian and Beth, who is Shannon Sossaman's character. So we meet those two folks at this party. And then soon Leanne, Brian's ex, arrives at the party. And she tells Beth about Shelley's funeral that she's just come from. So all these people know each other. Leanne mentions interning with Shelley at St. Luke's, which was the hospital from the opening scene. And she argues that Shelley could not have killed herself, even though Beth says that Shelley was, quote, talking crazy at the end. Which, like, drowning yourself in a koi pond isn't really a method of suicide anyway. Like, you can't, I think it's actually been proven that you physically can't drown yourself. Because once you start to lose consciousness, like, you would immediately, like, remove yourself from the, you know, like, you can't kill yourself by just dunking your head underwater and staying there.
Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea. Unless... Yeah, I'm not sure.
I don't know how anybody could have guessed that was a suicide. A murder, maybe.
Well, yeah.
An accident, like if she fell into the koi pond and hit her head on a rock. But there really is no way that could have been suicide.
Right. It's a big leap.
Yeah.
To assume that if you find someone in the pond that they kill themselves.
Right. Yeah.
So...
So suddenly while they're talking, Leanne's cell begins to ring with a distinct melody that Leanne doesn't recognize. She's like, that's not my ringtone.
That's not my ringtone.
And Beth sees that the call is coming from Shelley's phone. They don't answer. They don't pick up the call. And the phone logs one missed call dated Monday, 10:17 p.m., even though right now it's Friday at 10:33. So they're like, huh, that's weird. They both listen to the voicemail that's dated June 12th, which is 3 days in the future from where they are now. Mm-hmm. And the voicemail is a troubling message in Leanne's own voice. So it's like she left the message, which obviously she did not because she didn't call the phone. So now we meet hot detective Jack Andrews. This is Ed Burns' character, who is tragically identifying his sister's body at the hospital after it was found by hikers. And from her decomposing mouth, he extracts a red ball, just like the one that we saw bob to the surface of the koi pond after Shelley drowned. Next, we're in Beth and Leanne's college course, hearing about the impact of child abuse, which is kind of comes into play later. Mm-hmm. And glancing out the window, Leanne sees through a flurry of leaves a figure in the street that is dressed all in white and is on fire, but then it vanishes. And then next, she sees centipedes crawling on and into Beth's hand that also disappear. So Leanne's seeing shit.
She's starting to
hallucinate.
Be scared.
Yeah. After class, Leanne confesses to Beth she hasn't been sleeping well before heading to the library. She works there until it closes at 10 o'clock, and walking home in the dark, she gets spooked, and she calls Beth. So some of the things spooking her. So she sees this, like, corpse-like face on a passenger in a passing bus. She sees these terrifying figures at a bus stop of a lady with, a like, a kid in a stroller. She's just seeing all this spooky shit all over the place. Really creeped out. So she calls Beth. She's on the phone with Beth. And Leanne arrives at a train overpass right at the date and time that her one missed call was logged at. And so, alarmed, Beth is rushing to meet her. She's like, that's only a couple blocks away. I'll be right there. And they stay on the phone. And then Leanne begins to say the very words that they heard on the voicemail. And just as Beth gets there, some force pushes Leanne off the overpass in front of a train. Through the passing train, Beth sees a figure on fire. And then with the train gone, she can see Leanne's body lying on the tracks and Leanne's hand dialing a number on her cell phone. And as officials inspect the body later, one removes from Leanne's mouth a red ball. Meredith is rolling her eyes.
Sorry. It doesn't make sense. It's stupid. Okay. Sorry.
Okay. No, I will give you thing. That it's stupid, but I not that it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense yet.
It doesn't make
sense. I know. But it is stupid. Like, no, you're not wrong.
I think it would make more sense if it's like the people, the viewers saw that, or the person who saw that saw mm-hmm. the red ball, and then it wasn't there.
Oh, like, then it, like, disappeared?
Yeah, if it was, like, manifested. Because it's, like, weird that there's, like, physically something there because of this.
Interesting.
You know, like, continue, like, seeing things mm-hmm. and feel like, oh, what the heck is this?
Why,
like,
is there physical evidence?
Right. Hmm. I think that's the thing that I think is odd.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, and we don't really know yet. We find out soon what this red ball actually is. But at this point, we don't really know that yet. So now at Leanne's memorial, Taylor, who is Beth's roommate, says that Shelley had received a call before she died, just like Leanne, from an old advisor who turned out to already be dead when the call was made. Beth confirms the story of Leanne's call, but Brian argues it's all BS. He's all pissed about it, like, this is bullshit. But then he sees centipedes crawling up a post and storms off. So we're like, ah, methinks he protests too much. Because he's also
He's like, seen. You're crazy if you're seeing things. He's like, I'm seeing things. I'm seeing scared. Things. Help me.
Help. So Beth goes after him. She finds him at a cafe and he has her listen to his own voicemail. He says it came from Leanne's phone the night she died, but it's his voice on the message. And it was dated Wednesday, which is today, 12:02 p.m. Right now it's 12:01. So we understand that he is on edge. Brian says he has been seeing things, but then he takes off again. When Beth calls after him that he forgot his phone, he delivers the exact line that we just heard on the voicemail before an explosion at a nearby construction site sends a length of rebar right through his chest. And I put, this is very Final Destination.
Yeah, totally.
Like, pretty much, like, almost exactly what has happened in Final Destination movies.
Yeah. Or I was thinking, like, The Omen. With oh, the investigative yeah. reporter guy, and suddenly yeah. his head's just chopped off.
Yeah, or the spire falling from the church and impaling the priest.
Yeah.
So it's definitely, it's got that vibe. Mm-hmm. But then before collapsing to the ground, he coughs out the problematic red ball.
Yes.
Okay. So after this has happened to Brian, Beth is at the police station and Detective Lee, who's played by Margaret Cho, Which is we don't see Margaret around much anymore. She was pretty hot there for a while.
Yeah.
And she's a real funny lady.
She's funny.
But anyway, she's got this little bit part as a detective. And Detective Lee tells Beth there were no voicemails on either Leanne or Brian's phones. Beth's like, I heard them. She's like,
you guys are tripping.
There was nothing there. After Beth leaves, Lee thinks her story is crazy, but she's talking to her colleague Jack, who we've already met. He does not think that it's crazy. And from this conversation, we learn.
Sorry.
it's very. Meredith's garden is gonna look amazing.
It's not watered. It's like dirt back there.
He's mowing dirt.
I'm glad that they're back there blowing around the leaves.
But yeah, so at this point we find out the red balls found in all the victims' mouths are actually hard candies, which they don't really look like. They look like glass balls. They're like too smooth and perfect to be a candy.
I mean, when I first saw the ball come out of the water in the first scene, mm-hmm. I was thinking like the changeling, like the
ball. It looked like a toy ball. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't really. I was like, what is that? And
yeah. And then the other ones that start coming out are when they're extracting. You're like, it's a marble? Yeah. It looks like a marble. Yeah. But it doesn't really, it's too smooth and clean and perfect to really look like a hard candy, but evidently that's what they are.
Yeah. It's a little fireball.
Yeah. So, Jack runs after Beth outside the police station and he shares that Shelley interned with his sister Jean at St. Luke's, and gives Beth his card. So, you know, St. Luke's is a connection for a lot of these characters that have died, for Jean, for Shelley, and for Leanne.
Yeah.
Beth arrives home to a piece of heavily decorated mail saying on the outside, please forgive your mommy. And she's like, fuck you. And she rips it up and throws it away. And then, but before she does that, we see like kind of like a flashback blue toned image of this older woman like smoking and just like staring malevolently and everything. So this is like, you know, we assume some memory Beth is having that is the reason why she's tearing up and throwing away this letter from mommy. Mommy dearest.
Your name's Marilyn.
Your name is Marilyn.
Sorry, I know this movie came out way before that, but it gave me those Insidious 2 vibes a little bit.
Yeah.
The mom.
Definitely. Thing. Yeah, the mom.
You know, the scary lady.
Good mom characters. Mm-hmm. So then Beth finds Taylor distraught that she might be next on the call list. Mm-hmm. So Beth takes the batteries out of both their phones and she's like, look, nobody's getting any calls tonight. We're good. Batteries are out of the phones. But in the middle of the night, they are awakened by the same weird melody ringtone coming from Taylor's phone. This time, there is an actual video of Taylor, and it's like these are old cell phones or whatever. So it's not super clear. You can't really tell what's going on in this video, but it's a video instead of a voicemail and they can't delete it. Mm-hmm. They also can't like cancel or like turn off the phone. They're like, just use up the rest of your minutes. And they're like, you don't understand. So they destroy the phone instead. Beth and Taylor go home and waiting for them there is the producer of a TV show called American Miracles, who is there looking to prey on Taylor's story for an episode on the show. The producer hands Taylor a cell phone because, you know, she just destroyed her. So he's like, here, take this one. And as Beth is trying to bustle Taylor away from this nonsense, because Beth is like, this is all bullshit. Like, leave us alone. Leave her alone.
Yeah.
The phone that he has handed Taylor starts to ring with the same melody. And then on it is the same video of Taylor's death that had appeared on her own cell phone that they destroyed.
And they're like, that was rude.
Yeah, what the fuck
were
you doing?
We were cool until you came over here.
Thanks a lot, dickhead. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a real quick scene where we see Jack going through his sister's belongings. And then we jump back to Beth waking up the next morning to a note from Taylor saying that she's going to her parents. She's like, I need to be with my mom and dad right now. Mm-hmm. She answers the doorbell. And while doing so, Beth has another flashback of herself as a young girl looking through some door peephole, but, you know, still just not a lot of explanation for these memories yet, before finding Detective Jack on her porch. And she's like, oh, hello.
She's like, Dermot Mulroney, no.
What are you doing here?
Other guy.
There's supposed to be Ed Burns.
Ed Burns.
So Jack says he's confirmed using phone records that the chain of calls happened just as they thought. He's like, okay, they weren't on the cell phones, but when you look at the phone records, they were there. And mm-hmm. he's on his way to see about the person who called his sister to try and trace it back to the source. Because they're like, well, Shelly called Leanne and Jean called Shelly. Now we got to find out who called Jean. Beth demands to go with him to see this person, who he says is a nurse from an old age home named Marie Layton. So evidently Marie Layton is the one that called Jack's sister Jean. At her apartment with no one home, Beth and Jack, of course, just break in. And they find an apartment that has clearly been left vacant for a while. It's messy and disgusting. But Jack also starts noticing things that have been present in many of the visions the victims have seen. He sees some centipedes outside the window. There's a jar with other centipedes. There's a creepy toy figurine that looks just like, you know, some of the images that people have seen.
There's a bowl full of cough drops. I'm just kidding.
Beth, on the other hand, she finds a photo that's been ripped up. And when she puts the pieces back together, it's a photo of Marie Layton with two little girls that are identified as Ellie and Laurel. Laurel being the one from the fire at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then Jack discovers a disc from a nanny cam. So they, you know, load it into the laptop and the disc is video of Ellie and Laurel. But whatever held the nanny cam is gone now. They figure out like, oh, from the angle, it should be here, but there's nothing here. And it's just this like benign footage of the two girls in their bedroom. So then Jack startles Beth with the sound of an asthma inhaler that he's picked up and she runs out of the apartment. And then outside, she tells him that she heard that same noise right before both Leanne's and Brian's deaths. So she's been present at these two of these deaths already, like physically there. And she heard this noise, this asthma inhaler noise. And so that's why it spooked her so much. Back at the police station, trying to find a record of Marie Layton's death, they instead find the record of the girl Ellie's death from an asthma attack. CPS records reveal that in response to the suspicions about the death, the mother was questioned by a nurse at St. Luke's, Jack's sister Jean. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, well, there's that connection. Next, we see that Taylor has agreed to go on the American Miracles show. So as soon as she's out of the house and away from Beth being like, this is ridiculous, Taylor's like, let's do it. And they're all set up to film in a church at the date and time that Taylor's missed call indicated. So we're like, okay, well, if this is the time you're supposed to die, we're going to have all these cameras up. We're going to blah, blah, blah. And catch it for this. It's going to be the
capture the magic.
Yeah, the best episode of the season. Meanwhile, Beth and Jack go through...
Late night with the devil.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what they were hoping for.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So Beth and Jack go through Jean's files and find her notes of the various injuries that both Ellie and Laurel sustained. And I love that I put expert college student Beth declares it was Munchausen by proxy. She's like, I know what this is. I can diagnose this because I'm a second year psych major. We're like, okay, Beth, calm down. Okay. Yeah. and then right then they happen to glance over to a TV that's on showing the upcoming episode of American Miracles and saying that Taylor's going to be on it. So this is Beth is finding out now that Taylor has made the poor choice of going on this episode. She's like, wait, what the fuck? I can't leave this girl alone for 5 minutes.
With all TV production, it airs live all the time, right on your television.
Exactly.
Immediately.
So Beth and Jack rush to the filming location, which, again, they knew where?
Yeah, there's only one.
There's only one church.
There's only one in town. And only one. She knew exactly where to go.
Yep. So they're headed there as the, quote, exorcism begins. But they're not giving Taylor an exorcism. They're giving the cell phone an exorcism.
Okay.
Oh, of course. Mm-hmm. Taylor continues to have visions throughout. Like, she's seeing stuff all over the church as the lights go out and smoke fills the space. In the dark and smoke, Beth can't find Taylor when she gets there. She's like, Taylor, where are you? But the cameras catch Taylor being choked by an unseen force. And as her time of death passes, the lights return, smoke disappears, and Taylor is dead. A red hard candy rolling out of her lifeless mouth. Mm-hmm. Wah, wah, wah. That's why you don't go on TV.
Everyone knows.
Everyone knows that. But then Beth's cell phone begins to ring with the same melody, giving her her time of death, which is tomorrow at 7:55 p.m. So, moving on with the kill list. Jack tries to get police protection for Beth, and failing that, he asks if she can go to her parents. She says her father is dead, and she and her mother, quote, don't talk very much. And we're like, that's an understatement.
My mom's a real piece of shit.
She won't stop smoking. But so Jack is determined to stay at Beth's house with her. And I put, yes, please. Mm-hmm. As she awaits her doom, we get the rest of the story about her mom, who, you know, abused her, burned her with cigarettes, and her dad, who knew about the abuse, but hung himself instead of stopping it. Mm-hmm. Which is like, thanks, Dad.
Yeah, he sucks too.
Yep.
And then she's like, does it say explicitly she's like, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing with my life?
No, I think we have to
like understand that she wants to go help other children.
Abused children. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's so compassionate. Mm-hmm. So now Jack gets a call that Laurel, little blonde-haired Laurel, has been located in a foster home where she's been since the fire at St. Luke's. So they go to see her, and Jack tries to get Laurel to say where her mother is, but Laurel doesn't speak. They're like, she hasn't talked since the fire.
Well, she's like, I'm so compassionate. My mom is abusive. She's like, you better talk, Kev.
And she starts screaming at this traumatized child.
This is a whole piece of shit situation. Yeah. And then she storms off.
Yeah. It's like, it sucks in both ways because you're like, yeah, that's bullshit. And I love that like Jack calls her out on it too. It's like, wow, you really got away with kids.
He's
but
like,
at the
you
same
suck.
Time,
you're very bad at this.
It's like, she's, you know, she's got like 5 hours to live. So obviously she's panicking.
Yeah.
But while Jack is trying to get Laurel to talk, she does press her teddy bear's tummy so that it begins playing its song, which is the melody from the ringtone. So we're like,
It's all connected.
It's all connected. It's the bear.
It's the nanny cam company.
The new technological horror.
Yeah, the nanny cam company is
killing people.
Caretakers. All over town. All over the world. Okay.
So Jack and Beth decide to split up because, you know, they're short on time. Jack is going to go try to find Marie through the police database. And Beth is going to go research what happened at St. Luke's. Mm-hmm. So they're like, we need answers. We don't have a lot of time. So we're not going to do that smart thing and stick together.
We got to figure it out.
Yep. Beth ends up finding the doctor who was on duty in the children's ward at St. Luke's when the fire happened. And the doctor recalls Laurel and confirms that her mother was there. She's like, she was always there. We're like, what does that mean? So then with the theory that Marie Layton was killed in the fire, but her body was never found, Beth heads to St. Luke's. You know, so it's that age-old chestnut of, you know, the spirit is reaching out because the corpse needs to be laid to rest.
Right.
Right? And so she's like, okay, well, if she died in the fire and her body's still in there somewhere, then we need to find her body so that she can be at rest and she'll stop killing people.
The vengeful spirit.
Yep.
Like Samara.
Exactly. So that's you know, Beth's operating theory right now. So she heads to St. Luke's. She wanders through the spooky, burned-out building. She's plagued by visions, and she's attacked by, you know, entities until Jack arrives. But even though he's like, oh, I'm here to rescue you.
The centipedes come.
The centipedes come, and they barricade the door. So now they do get trapped inside the hospital. So Jack's there like, I got you, girl, but now I can't get you out. Mm-hmm. Soon the spirits manage to separate the two of them, and they manifest another ringing phone to Beth before luring her into a vent, thinking that it's a way out of the room she's trapped in. So as she crawls through the ducts, Beth sees charred handprints along the surface she's crawling on. So we're like, okay. And then she finds Marie's burned corpse, still clutching a cell phone with a call in progress. Mm-hmm. So we're like, she was right all along because like, so Marie was trapped in the fire and it was her charred handprints. She crawled through this duct, but she couldn't get out and she died in this duct. Mm-hmm. And she's making calls, you know. You have to keep up with your correspondence. Check in with people once in a while.
I just have to check this on this order. That I
I gotta answer these texts. anywho, so Beth takes the phone and smashes it, but then Marie's corpse like animates, you know, it comes to life and it begins chasing Beth. And so they're crawling, you know, in pursuit through the vents. Beth gets pinned in the duct by the corpse, and Beth begs it not to be hurt. And so the corpse starts crying, mm-hmm. like a little, like her super burned, like mangled, you know, remains of a face. There's like little teardrops slipping down the scarred flesh. It's a very touching moment. And then moments later, Jack comes upon them in the duct. And that now the corpse is like back to just being a corpse. Like it's not animated anymore. Mm-hmm. And both Jack and Beth get out of the building safely. So we're like, phew. So we think
that was a close call.
It certainly was. And now we must have solved the problem, right? Because mm-hmm. we found her body and she'll be laid to rest and she will stop making these toxic phone calls.
All the bad stuff.
Yeah. Which like the world we live in now, any phone call is toxic. Nobody wants to call. Or be no. called.
No.
That's no. Thank you. Thank you. No, thank you. So moments later, okay, they both get out of the building safely. Beth's time of death has passed, so it seems the curse is broken. Jack takes Beth home. And I said she lays the groundwork for them to hook up. She's like, you want to come inside? And he's like, I should really go. And she's like, you call me tomorrow? And he's like, okay, I'll call you tomorrow.
And you're like, this is believable.
Yeah, 100%. She's like, as soon as the curse is broken, she is hot for this man.
She's hot for him. Also, she's like 20-something, and he's like...
30-something. I don't... May, December, baby.
I don't know about
Let's
this.
Do it.
Okay.
But, you know, Jack does... He's like, I'll call you tomorrow, but then he leaves to notify Laurel about her mother, because that's what you do in the middle of the night, is go tell a six-year-old that they found the burned corpse of her mother in the hospital.
Yeah.
So when they get there, Laurel, shockingly, is asleep, because it's the middle of the night and she's a child. But then Jack sees one of her drawings pinned to a board, and he gets a hunch from it, so he checks her teddy bear. It turns out the teddy bear was the nanny cam all along, and it still has a disc inside it. So watching the footage on the disc, he sees that it was Ellie that cut Laurel. And this is the part where you really realize Ellie is played by Ariel Winter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like a young Ariel Winter. So it was like she might have already been doing Sophia the First. But no, because she started Sophia the First after she was on Modern Family. But this was pre-Modern Family. Like she's young.
Oh, I didn't recognize her.
Yeah. So Ariel Winter plays Ellie. And so it was actually the sister that cut Laurel, not the mom. So, mm-hmm. you know, Beth's diagnosis, I guess, was premature after all.
Yeah.
Even though she's like a professional.
She's like, I've been here and
I know everything.
I did my one class.
Mm-hmm. And I saw this one document and I'm prepared to sign off on this. In fact, it was actually Ellie who was responsible for all of Laurel's injuries. So everything that was noted in all of Jean's, like, you know, I almost put witness protection, child protection, notes about like the potential abuse, all of those injuries that that Laurel sustained, were from Ellie, from her sister.
Yeah. And then you're like wondering, okay, so mom didn't say anything or mom said it was her big sister was doing this to my child.
You know, I think that because when you have, like, if she didn't see it, obviously, you would think that it was just an accident, right? And then that's the story that sounds suspicious when you take your child in to the hospital to get treated for something and you're like, oh, it was just an accident. Or even if you can't explain how it happened, the fact that you weren't paying attention, that you weren't supervising, or you know, that they were not being properly supervised. But yeah, so on the video is when we see Marie, the mom, actually learning for the first time that it's Ellie that's hurting Laurel. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so obviously she's livid. She, you know, takes Laurel, she bustles her away, and she locks Ellie in the bedroom. And so this is all we're seeing on the nanny cam footage, that of course in her like panic about being locked in the room, Ellie starts to have an asthma attack, and she dies from the asthma attack while the teddy bear's music plays in the background and while Ellie desperately tries to call for help on a cell phone. And so now we see like all of these elements that have been part of the haunting, like they're all like traced back to this moment of Ellie's death.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so now awake, Laurel has like appeared behind Jack and the foster mother who are watching this video. And she delivers her one line from the movie where she reveals that Ellie always gave her a candy after she hurt her. And so that's the connection for the hard candy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Meredith is so impressed. Everything's getting tied together. Don't you feel the satisfaction?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Anywho.
Keep going.
Okay. So now, but here's the problem, is that Beth is at home thinking that Marie was the evil spirit and that they satiated her, while Jack is off somewhere discovering that Marie wasn't the problem all along, that it was Ellie's spirit that has been, you know, taking its vengeance on all of these people.
Being terrible.
Absolutely. So now we jump to the police station, and in a box of evidence that was collected from St. Luke's, a cell phone begins playing the melody. A cop listens to the voicemail that gets left that is logged at 11 o'clock, even though it's now 10:30. And we hear Beth's terrified voice on the recording. So the cop calls Jack to fill him in on everything. And then Jack returns to Beth's house. And so then he's inside and he's like, it wasn't Marie, it was Ellie, blah, blah, you know, and Beth's like, what's going on? You're back so soon. I'm glad I showered.
You're back so soon.
You couldn't stay away. But then there's another knock on the door and Jack goes to answer. Beth delivers the screams that we heard on the voicemail right before a knife plunges through the peephole of the door into Jack's face.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the end for Jack. And it all really does line up because the cell phone that was ringing that received the call in the evidence box was actually Jack's cell phone. And he had given it to Beth at the hospital and she had dropped it at the hospital. And so it was collected there and put into this evidence bag. So we understand when Jack gets killed that it was his phone that received the call. And that's why it was him that got killed and not Beth.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All makes sense. It's seamless.
Seamless. No plot holes.
No plot holes
anywhere
at all. So now the windows of the house all explode inward. And I put Ellie is there in all her ghastly, jittery glory. So she's got this like spooky ghost demon face and she's moving all like that kind of stuttery, pixelated, like spooky kind of way that we see ghouls or whatever move sometimes in scary movies.
And she has her hood on.
She has her hood on because she's tough.
She looks very mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
Teenager and mad.
Yeah. But she's not a teenager. She's little. She's like, I think they
I
said.
I was like preteen? Not like
I think 15? It said like she 12? Was 10.
Oh, okay.
On the photo. The ages on the photo, I think, were 10 and 6 for Ellie and Laurel. But that could have been an older photo. But she's still pretty little. But before Ellie's like spirit can get to Beth, the spirit of Marie appears and stops her, sending Ellie's spirit swirling back into Jack's cell phone. So it's like we freed Mom from where she was imprisoned at the hospital and she's still trying to help.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because that's Beth does say that a little bit earlier that like that Marie was Marie called her to the hospital to try and help her or try to warn her.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we see again Marie's spirit stepping up and, you know, kind of like taking responsibility for her demon child, which actually happens in one of the Freddy Krueger movies, too. Amanda Krueger, his mother, appears in one of the sequels.
She's like, sorry.
Yes, sorry about that. And yeah, because it was, I think it was Dream Child, which is the fourth one. Fifth one? Fourth one. Because it's like there's like this toxic baby Freddy.
Sorry about my little scamp.
Yeah, and she like she resorbs him into her uterus. And then she's like, stay away. But anyway, this idea that a mother's responsibility for her child, you know, extends into the afterlife, which I'm thrilled to learn. Honestly, I couldn't be happier that I'm still responsible for their actions even after we're all dead.
Yeah.
But anyway, so
better get ready.
Yep. Marie saves Beth and casts Ellie back into the cell phone. And so we think it's all over. But just as Marie retreats, a candy falls from Jack's mouth and his cell phone begins dialing. Mm-hmm. And it fades to black as credits roll over the sound of the ringing phone.
Continuing.
So it's the cycle has not been broken.
Nothing happened.
Nothing. No, nothing changed anything. But Beth's alive.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But anyway.
To go make misdiagnosis.
Right. To give everybody Munchausen by proxy. So I guess I'll ask, Meredith, did you think this was scary?
No. No. Also,
did you think this was good?
No. I think it's interesting because I watched a I watched a few like reaction like or other
review things
reviews on YouTube. I wish I could remember his name, but he gave a little bit of a history of Japanese horror remakes.
Okay.
And how there are some real bangers that came out, like the Ringu, The Grudge, those, and then Japan was, you know, creating a bunch of really great high quality horror movies, but then towards the end there, they're just doing more money grabs, like, like, you know, which makes sense, and we are guilty of that as well.
Yeah.
And so they're producing some ones that were not really good, and that they made One Missed Call, which was not great. And it was like the idea, he was explaining, you know, the source material wasn't great to begin with. And then the Americans remade it because they had so many. Because
that's what we do.
Yes. So many great results from The Ring and The Grudge. And so he talked about how The Ringu was directed by Gore Verbinski, and it was amazing, the the remake. And then The Grudge was directed by the original director.
The Japanese director?
Okay. And so then that was with Sarah Michelle Gellar, and it was very well done. And this was created with not much thought or money or whatever in Japan, or excuse me, maybe not money, but cash grab.
Right.
Then it was remade here. No name director, but for some reason, this movie cost $20 million to make.
Jesus Christ.
For some reason.
How is that possible? They, like, we burned down an actual hospital.
Yeah. And it was like he talked about in comparison, like A Quiet Place was $17 million to make. And a lot of other very movies did very well were made for much less. For some reason, this one was cost a lot to make, which I thought was really surprising, actually. And
it was all those candies.
Yeah. And he was like, for what? Like, I don't.
All the big names. Did you not hear me list all the big name performers?
Ed Burns was like, I will die. 10 million or I walk.
Yeah. Margaret Cho was like, I need me some Netflix special money.
Yeah. So then this movie was like a catastrophic failure. It was like 0% fresh and everyone hated it. But it's not, I felt like there was not much redeeming in this movie. And I looked for it. I was like, mate, you know, I wanted someone to root
something
for.
Nice
I wanted
to
something.
Say.
I wanted something to root for. I think Ed Burns did fine, you know, and it was okay. And, but there's a lot of missed opportunities, I think. But it seemed like it was a struggle when the source material was not that great to start with.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. So, none of these thoughts are mine. It's not original. Like, this credit where credit is due. That guy who did the video explained more about it. And I was like, I didn't know that about this movie.
It makes sense.
And the history and why it was kind of a stinker. I do like the cover art.
Yeah, cover is pretty freaky.
And the girl who was the one who went to the library, who was, I like her.
The one that, oh, Leanne.
Yeah, she was in 28 Days.
Oh.
Not 28 Days Later, but 28 Days.
Oh, with Sandra Bullock?
Yes. Who was in recovery, and she played the teenage, like, heroin addict. But then she was also in a lot of shows and things in the late 90s. So
that's funny. So the one person that I didn't recognize, so I didn't look up, is the only one that you recognized.
Literally. Well, she wasn't blonde end, though other stuff, she okay. had like kind of black hair, bangs, and a short bob.
Oh, okay.
And totally different look than in this movie where mm-hmm. she has the long blonde hair. But yeah, I don't know. I liked the twist where it was the sister. Mm-hmm. I feel like there is a lot more they could have done with it, though.
Yeah.
Like the reveal. Like, I understand that that was supposed to be the reveal. Mm-hmm. I understand that it was supposed to be the mom that was the problem and the haunting that was
in the misdirection was, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, but I just wish there was more substance to it. Because the idea of a call and there's something that will is malevolent that will get you because, and it's not within your power to change it and mm-hmm. you're in someone's phone directory and they'll just call you and pass the curse on uh-huh. is an interesting idea.
Yeah.
It sort of felt like, you know, The Ring showing a movie to somebody yeah. or whatever, or, you know, exposing them to
it's a curse. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Or like entering the house, like The Grudge or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. But I don't know. I feel like maybe it'll be a concept or idea that might be revisited, but hopefully in a more skilled or more creative mm-hmm. way with more thought.
Yeah.
So did you think this is scary?
Not really. And I agree that it's not good. For some reason, I've gone back to it a time or two as like a background movie. And I'm not entirely sure why.
You're like, I just can't quit you.
I keep waiting for you Shoshana. To get better.
Is her name Shoshana?
Shannon.
Shannon, yeah.
Yeah.
Shannon.
Shannon, come on. You know, it's like the toxic relationship. Like, you keep going back to it even though you know it's not going to be different. It's not going to change. It's not going to get better. It's just going to keep hurting you.
That's how I feel about Rob Zombie remakes.
Yeah. You keep going back wanting something different.
Although I did, Lords of Salem is not a remake. Mm-hmm. It was a good one, though. So, anyway, continue.
You know, if there's not much more of value to say about this movie itself, since, like I mentioned at the beginning, that this is the only movie in our Summer of Tech that deals with phones, I thought that, you know, there's a couple of other movies, really, really great movies that we've already covered on this podcast or talked about on this podcast that integrate the use of phones. And particularly what I put down was obviously When a Stranger Calls.
Oh,
mm-hmm. And then the other one is Black Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
And so kind of looking at, you know, the potential for being afraid or like fear or terror through the use of like phone communication, mm-hmm. basically. Because obviously in both When a Stranger Calls and Black Christmas, those were, you know, the 70s, and it was just a landline and it was actually a live human calling. But what we had kind of talked about in the past with that is that back when you had a landline like that, you know, you were kind of at the mercy of, like, anybody could dial you, anybody could call you.
Yeah. Like before
caller ID or, you know, cell phones or anything like that. You know, and it's like, well, yeah, you could unplug your phone. Yeah, you could whatever. But, you know, we relied on phones. We used phones. And so you didn't want to be without your phone line. But your phone line was just open to the world. And when you picked it up, you had no idea who you were about to be speaking to. And so that like created like a feeling of vulnerability and like that you were exposed in some way, that you could be preyed upon. You know, by something, and it didn't even have to be something supernatural. It could just be something frightening or something dangerous, mm-hmm. you know? And so with this, it kind of had like that same element, like you were saying, that the curse that, you know, you can't do anything about it. You know, your phone, just your number was in someone else's phone. You received this call and now like you're stuck with it. You're kind of helpless. Mm-hmm. Right. Until you have to solve the mystery and find the corpse and punch the little dead girl in the face and all of that stuff that you need to do to break the curse. But, you know, I think that's where the potential for scary content when it comes to telephones could come from, mm-hmm. is that like it's a disembodied voice, you know, in its essence, like You don't know where it's coming from. You don't know. You're not like speaking to somebody right in front of you. Mm-hmm. And in a, you know, a different context, like, you know, a landline, a cell phone, a voicemail, anything like that, there's, you know, that like unknown element of where it's coming from, who it is, like what they're doing, what they're saying, that leaves it open to be scary.
Right.
Like yeah. this, you know, one missed call, maybe the problem was that the story was too complex. Like they tried too hard to have all these little, there were supposed to be like clues and hints and elements that then, look, when we give you the big reveal at the end, we're going to tie it up with this nice big bow. And you're going to be like, oh my God, that's amazing. It all makes sense now. But maybe they got too bogged down in all of those little, like, it didn't need to be that much. Right, and if it was less, it might have been more frightening.
Yeah. It, well, and then I think that this movie vlogger and I kind of, I was thinking the same thing, but he also voiced it too. It was like, the main character, she's just like, oh, that today's only Friday. This is a Monday. Or like just giving more tidbits of like, oh, this call or that message says it was for... in on this day, that's 3 whole days from
yeah,
now.
Yeah, they have to like, give so much information.
Like, oh my God, this is so much.
It's laborious.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like that's all they're adding to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, okay, so that's all you're here for is just like telling me when a call is coming, when it's supposed to happen. That's not happened yet. Oh, that's in 6 hours. Okay. And you're like,
but today's only Friday. Today's only Friday. The 12th is Monday. And mm-hmm. today, now it's Monday. And the library closed. It's at 10 o'clock, like the flash. But
yeah, it's
again,
too much.
Like that was in Final Destination.
True.
They, and I would say, at least in the original, you know, we won't speak to all the sequels, but they made it feel less, we were less encumbered by that information. But there was a lot of that, like, well, we need to flash to the clock. We need to show you what time it is. We need to show you, like, you know, what's happening in order to build the suspense, to tell the story. And so maybe the difference is in Final Destination, it was really just that factor. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the date and time of the call, the candy in the mouth, the visions all being the sound of the asthma inhaler, the song from the teddy bear.
There's random centipedes.
Random centipedes. So it maybe it was just like that was too like, oh, like it was heavy lifting, right?
Well, The Ring did the same thing.
That's
watch
true.
The video,
the imagery.
Get a call. 7 days. Hang yeah. up. What?
But
and then
did
you
they...
see weird things. And then Naomi Watts throughout, she's like, I have 4 days left.
Yeah.
Or have, but it was he wasn't like, how many more days do you have? I have 4 more days. Let's look at the let's look at my Google calendar and count the date. I don't know. It just seemed
yeah,
too
you're
much
right that it's
annoying.
It was very, very similar to how the images, and well, like maybe one of the differences, the images in The Ring served a purpose because they helped Naomi Watts hone in on Samara.
They helped
her locate, yeah, and solve the mystery. But then also in The Ring, it was truly images. It wasn't just I had a vision of this thing on the street and then it was gone. They had the video.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you know, that's how she finds the lighthouse, is by dragging the video, the film, to the side. And then she sees the lighthouse and then she goes in the book and, you know, figures out it's this island,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, potentially that could have happened if it was just like hallucinatory visions that she was having rather than a tape that she could keep going back to and rewatching. But the visions or the images in The Ring served that purpose of helping her solve the mystery, which it doesn't really seem like any of the visions or images from One Missed Call actually assisted or helped.
No.
I'm trying to think. I can't think of any.
Aside from just
that
being
served a purpose.
Off-putting or creepy.
Yeah. Which, and that's the thing. Like, if it had just, maybe if they had dropped a lot of the other stuff and kept the spooky stuff that they were seeing. Because some of those ghostly faces, like, the effects weren't great. But a lot of the images of the creepy stuff that they were seeing was actually spooky.
Mm-hmm.
But you had the spooky images, then you had the centipedes, then you also had the burning lady, which we realize later is supposed to be Marie, right, in her white nurse's dress. Mm-hmm. And so if it had just been the spooky image, it was too chaotic.
Yeah.
Maybe. Because there's that part when Beth is wandering through the hospital before she finds Marie's corpse, and she's seeing creepy stuff around. And at one point she opens the door, and that baby from the stroller vision is sitting in a crib, and it turns and looks at her, and it's holding a cell phone. And it's that could have been creepy. The effects were really bad because it was digital. It was done digitally, and really poorly.
Right.
And so it was it wasn't scary because it was ugh. Okay.
And she's and you're
really? Beth, calm down.
Okay. Yeah.
And then the backstory with her mom and maybe that wasn't really necessary. Mm-hmm. But then if they eliminated that, would we be complaining that they didn't develop her character enough?
I don't know, maybe. But it's they're trying to give her a little more depth, I think. Yeah. Also, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of other movies that have phones as well. There's Cell by Stephen King.
I didn't know that. Oh, I read the book. I've never seen the movie. Because it was John
Cusack
and Sam Jackson, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was okay. The movie was fine. And then there was one more I was going to mention, but it just slipped my mind. But yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah,
I think this is not a great representation of a phone haunting.
Yeah, situation. And there's potential.
Oh,
there's potential.
Black phone. That's what I was thinking. Black.
Oh,
phone.
Black phone. Yeah, mm-hmm. I just watched that yesterday with Tommy. He'd never seen it.
Yeah, that was good. And there's going to really be a second one.
Yeah.
Two.
Yeah. So you're right then. There's potential for a phone to be a frightening tool in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
This movie didn't really pull it off.
Yeah, they're just trying to grasp at a lot of different straws, a lot of different tropes, different things that were found in different Japanese movies and other and the remakes. This is how much time you have. This is different images you'll see before you die. Mm-hmm. It seemed they were just trying to throw everything at the wall to see what sticks.
Yeah,
that was the feeling for me.
So yeah, I mean, obviously, I wouldn't. While I do, I would say that I like this movie. I have watched it a couple of times. I wouldn't recommend it to people.
You keep going back to it.
I do keep going back to it, but I wouldn't recommend it to people. I would be you can watch it. It's not good. I would tell people it's not good.
That's okay. Yeah. Everyone has those movies where you're I keep watching this. I can't stop, but this is not a good movie.
No, stay away. Mine. It's my precious.
This is my garbage.
My personal garbage.
This is my garbage.
I don't share it with anyone.
No. Sorry, Ed Burns. Yeah. But hopefully our next movie
we'll redeem the podcast as a whole.
Hopefully you will enjoy it. You have not seen it.
I have not seen it yet. I'm looking forward to checking it out.
Yeah, it came out during the shutdown, and it's called Host. It's not a huge time suck. It's an hour and 5 minutes or something. And it came out in 2020. And it was one of those where I'm I have zero expectations, and I was pleasantly surprised.
Okay.
It's not groundbreaking, but it's a fun one. Yeah. So I hope you enjoy it more than
I guarantee you I will. I don't think anybody could enjoy anything less than you enjoyed One Missed Call.
I tried.
I know. She's thank God that's over.
I messaged Katie.
She's I'm 10 minutes into it and I just checked to see how much is left.
I was how much more? It has to be almost finished. I'm only 15 minutes in. God damn it.
And I just couldn't believe it. It was one of my longer recaps. Why? And then I realized that it is because there's so much. They put so much in it.
They threw all the stuff into it.
Yeah, and that was probably their downfall.
Yeah. Well, all the remakes can't be amazing, groundbreaking, The Ring and The Grudge. Those are insane. Those are really good. Even Shudder, though, that was a tie remake.
I love
remake,
The Forest. I think we should do The Forest sometime.
The Forest was, I'm sad. I love that one. It was so good. Sad. But anyway. So watch
Host.
Not the Stephanie Meyer's book one, but...
what?
There's a book called Host, I think. But with Saoirse... Oh, shoot. She's...
Saoirse Ronan?
Yeah. Oh. She plays the lead. But okay. Anyway, you know, don't watch that one. All right. Bye.
Bye.